This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is cellist Yo-Yo Ma, who at the age of 31 is already considered one of the most inspired classical musicians playing today. Boston Globe music critic Richard Dyer wrote about him, "There is no cellist at all, and indeed hardly any virtuoso of any instrument, who is as complete, profound, passionate, and humane a musician as Ma." Before we hear the interview, let's listen to Ma's performance of the prelude from Bach's Suite No. 3 in C major for unaccompanied cello. That was Yo-Yo Ma's performance of the prelude from Bach's Suite No. 3 in C major for unaccompanied cello. Yo-Yo Ma was born in Paris, where his parents had emigrated from China to study classical music. His mother was a singer, his father a violinist and musicologist. Yo-Yo Ma got his earliest training from his father, beginning at age 4. By the time the family moved to New York when Ma was 7, he could already play several of the Bach cello suites. When Ma was in his mid-teens, he rebelled against the discipline and structure imposed by his parents and teachers. He even considered giving up music. But his exposure to young, accomplished musicians at music camp and at music festivals inspired him to dedicate himself to music with a newfound, self-imposed discipline. Ma studied at Juilliard from ages 9 to 16. When it was time for college, he went to Harvard because he wanted to get away from the insularity of the conservatory. He told me why.
Well, I'd graduated early from high school, and I was about really early. I was about 15 when I graduated, and so my choices were to stay. I took a year off, went to Juilliard for a year, and so the choice was to whether I could stay there for the next 4 years, or enter some competitions, which I didn't particularly want to do, and because that's never much fun, or do something else, because I really didn't feel mature enough to go out and do it. And there was time on my hands. My sister was at college also, and I'd visited, and I thought it was a fantastic environment. And so off I went. And so, but in hindsight, it was just really the best thing I could have done, because I came from a fairly narrow musical background, and college just, I don't know, I was put in the company of a lot of peer group, that a lot of people who were interested in, as interested in their own field that I might have been interested in music. And it just really forced me to expand my views and put together, you know, all kinds of things that I wanted to be able to put together, like from different cultural backgrounds, you know, so I studied history and literature and anthropology. And it just gave me a worldview that I think freed myself from becoming a neurotic.
One thing I could see a lot of musicians worrying about if they're out of the conservatory environment is that they're spending time learning about history or literature, that it's precious minutes they should really be putting into learning more about music or practicing. You can get very obsessed. So did you ever feel this, almost guilt that, oh, sure, it was wonderful to learn about the rest of the world, but you had to keep just working at music all the time?
Well, the thing is, like, I guess I was lucky in the sense that I had very, very good early training from my father, and I had very, very good training from Leonard Rose, who is my main teacher, and his assistant, Channing Robbins. And so so by the time I went to college, it was, you know, I had the basic wherewithal to, you know, to know how to practice, how to work on things. But I think what is something that we sometimes lose track of is that is the old, you know, technique versus musicianship conflict. And it really shouldn't be a conflict, because how can you learn? There's some teachers that say, you know, you have to first learn technique and then you'll talk about musicianship. But how can you do that if you've spent 18 years learning how to play an instrument perfectly? And then what choices do you have? I mean, what are you going to do with music? Because music is ultimately... it's content, the emotional content and a content of what people thought about, you know, 100, 200, 300 years ago, as well as today. And the philosophies of the time affect composers. And that's something that's a constant, it's a constant learning process. You're always challenging, you know, what you think you know. You're always putting together more things. You know, you look at art, you read philosophy, you read all of those things, and it helps performances. There's no question about it.
A common complaint that music critics and listeners have is that young musicians can be very technically proficient, but they don't have the musical depth and the transcendence that is sometimes acquired with age. You are always cited as one of the exceptions to that. But I was wondering if you feel that your music is changing as you get older, if you feel...
Oh, absolutely. Uh-huh. I mean, I think there's so many different ways to say something. And when you're young and the first time you go do something, it's so exciting. You have so much energy. You're discovering the world for the first time. And so, talk about critics, you know, yeah, the critics will write about, you know, youthful exuberance and, you know, enthusiasm and all of that stuff, which is great. As you get older, I guess what's desirable is that you care more about things. You care more about saying something right, or you care more about really finding the right words to describe something, the right emotional character for every note. Caring, you become a better performer. You know, I think the graph of a musician is that when you're young, you're on top of the instrument, you're a master of the instrument. As you get towards, you know, 60, 70, you lose a little bit of that, but your command of space, of your just sheer authority of being able to say something maybe important simply, you know, without any affect, without any kind of just excess energy, but you just find the right amount of way to do it, is just much greater. So so definitely it changes as you grow older.
Do you listen back to tapes or records that you made when you were younger?
Yeah, I can't stand it generally, because there are things that you discover about sound, about character, again, about music, that that once you discover, it becomes part of your knowledge. Whereas I can really identify times, gee, I made this recording when I was 24, and I didn't know this then. And since then, I've discovered it. So I'm aware of a lack of something.
Is there any discovery like that you could put into words?
Sure. Well, you know, vibrating. I used to be I was a real fan of Casals, you know, but when I met Casals, he was 94 and I was 17, you know, and by that time he had less of the technical aspects of playing the instrument, but much more of a kind of just very deep sense of what music was all about. I mean, again, the command of time and everything. So, but in his playing, some people would complain that, you know, his sound was ugly. He didn't vibrate. He moaned and groaned. But for me, all those sounds were just so deeply connected to everything that he lived in his life, you know, and I loved it. So I think at some level, I tried to imitate it. I didn't vibrate, you know, and all kinds of things. And then I realized, you know, this is kind of, maybe this is an affectation, or that you can only go so far with that in terms of giving expression to music. So then I started vibrating. I started, you know, working on my bow arm because I was tense. I was trying to make music come out in a way that made me not think about what I was doing, you know, physically. And so so I worked on that for a couple of years, and then I'd listen to singers, I'd listen to other instrumentalists, I'd thought about what, you know, an idea of what sound is like. You know, sound is what are, you know, overtones, what the core of sound, and all kinds of things. And so by working on that, then I started, you know, vibrating more. I started to say, well, there is something to why one should vibrate. There is something why one should make a beautiful sound, not for its own sake, but, you know, there's a place for everything. And so so the sound, the playing, the concept changed. I guess that's one example.
There's something very transcendent about your playing. I mean, you could even use the word spiritual about it. And I was wondering if you were religious in any way, in if you think that that's expressed at all through your music.
I think one of the things that always bothered me was that in all the different environments I came from, every one of them said, you know, we're the best. and that's one of the things you discover when you travel, that people have very specific points of view, and very few people, well, not that many people are interested in changing them, and you know, because something is true or isn't true or whatever. And I think that's something that I had a hard time growing up coming to terms with. You know, should you be more European than American, more Oriental than that? And finally I decided, look, you know, there's no reason why one shouldn't be, why these, you draw these artificial distinctions, because every culture celebrates its, you know, its own values, and you get some fantastic things in return for those values, and other things that don't quite work. And I think in performing music, it's one way of, I guess, music that tends to be ideal or uplifting, or whatever composers that, you know, that had an ideal of humanity, of a certain kind of humanity. You try and get that across. I mean, if that's the kind of spirituality, then that's what I'm trying to to achieve. That there's the goal is communicating some of that ideal to an audience every time, and of course it doesn't make much of a difference, and I think ultimately in anybody's lives, but maybe for half an hour, you could say something that's special, that's meaningful, and maybe, you know, you might think about it a week later, and, you know, that's it. So in that sense, you're contributing something.
My guest is cellist Yo-Yo Ma. You have a family now, and your performance schedule keeps you on the road or in the air a lot. Is it a constant conflict now between performance and family?
Yes and no. I think when Nicholas was a year old, I guess I turned 29, so which is, and in our life, it's like, since you're always thinking 2 years ahead, it was like turning 30. And so I kind of rethought a number of things, one of which was, where does one get the energy to live a family life and to, you know, and to go crazy on tour? And the result was that I think in my own mind, there was a very clear-cut priority that somehow family has to come first. Not necessarily first, meaning, you know, that, but just a mental picture of what one's whole life is like. And that one, if I think in some ways we're masters of our own destiny, or at least certainly in terms of time spent doing what. And the most important thing, I guess, that I realized was that one could say no and one could take time off. And once I realized that, it's been a much easier life to live with myself, with family, because I know that after I go away for 3 weeks or something, I know I have 3 weeks at home, or I know that I can spend, you know, a month and a half, 2 months, or as much time as the family needs, but you just have to plan it ahead, and that's my responsibility.
Does it give your music more meaning to have a life outside of music?
Oh, absolutely. I've never quite believed in having your identity totally tied up in your profession, no matter how wonderful that profession is. And I think I can function better as a musician when I can clear my head and go home and get exhausted and you know, be with my family. And then go back to work with the love and care, with renewed love and care. And I think so it does help.
You had an operation, I think, in 1980 for scoliosis, curvature of the spine?
Sure, curvature of the spine, yeah.
Yeah. Did you get that from playing cello when you were so young?
That's a difficult question. I think it's apparently a congenital disease, so that the tendency to have scoliosis is there at birth, and it may have been, just accentuated by, or the curve may have been determined by which way I hold the bow arm or whatever, and it may have gotten worse because I wasn't very physically active doing other things that may have counteracted, you know, the muscle development of when playing the cello, which is uneven because the right hand moves around and the left hand stays basically in one place. So, and I've observed that a lot of cellists, like in photographs with Rostropovich, with a lot of people, Misha Schneider, who recently passed away, that they always have a larger right shoulder than the left shoulder. And so some of it obviously comes from playing the cello. But it was, let's say I was 25 around that time, and it was an interesting thing to go through. One is that you're faced with a slight possibility of not being able to play again after the operation, should something happen, you know. And that was, it was wonderful because just before the operation, I thought to myself, well, you know, gee, it's been a very nice life. I've done a lot in music, and, you know, should I not play anymore? That's fine. I really came to terms with it. So I'm not worried about, you know, doors slamming on fingers and whatever today, because it's, this is like an extra life, you know, that you can, you get to do it. And if something happens, you'll just do something else, whatever that may be.
How did you time the operation? There's never a good time to go in the hospital and risk your life.
I think I took 6 months off. I had the operation in April and had the summer off. And, you know, and it was hot, but the summer season, you know, had a wonderful... Incidentally, I mean, taking that time off was also wonderful because it gave me a sense of what it was like not to play the instrument. And again, I'd been leading such a structured life because you follow your schedule to go from concert to concert. And suddenly having 6 months off was, my gosh, you know, what do I do with all this time?
Did it change your playing to not play for 6 months, to get away for a while?
Well, it's when you, it's, again, what happens is that you, you have to rebuild your playing, your stamina, your control, your muscles, I guess, are not the same. The atrophy a little bit, you don't have the same coordination. But it just made you think about how, what are the steps to rebuild. And that's always interesting. And I think that also gave me the courage to take lots of time off in the summer now, because it means that I know I can take time off, not touch the cello, and then, you know, and then slowly get back into shape and go back to playing. And it's wonderful, because whenever you take that time off, you rebuild, things come out slightly differently, and you learn new things, and you know you may change some bad habits. And it's scary. It makes you very insecure, because the first month that you're back playing, you don't have the confidence of, you know, knowing things will happen when you just think them, those thoughts, and they don't happen. You have to reanalyze, but it's good. I think you learn from, you grow by destroying things and putting them back together again, and so that's, it's good.
Your cello is from the early 1700s.
Right, that's right. The instrument I'm playing on right now is on loan to me from Jacqueline Dupré, who's the great English cellist who has had multiple sclerosis for the past 12 years and hasn't been able to play, which is one of the big tragedies. And she has a great instrument called the Davidoff. It's made by Stradivarius in 1712. And I feel very, very privileged to be able to play on this instrument.
Do you feel her presence in the instrument at all? Instruments are
Absolutely.
Just so personal to people.
Well, you know, there's this wonderful violin maker, or René Morel in New York, and he claims that the people who play a particular instrument affect the instrument, in the sense that, let's say, someone who, you know, wood is made out of fibrous material and is therefore flexible and can be exercised. I guess an instrument that isn't played like the Strad for a number of years, it took me about a year before the instrument, the sound opened up. And if an instrument is exercised in, let's say, by someone who favors the high end, you know, doesn't dig in deeply, so only part of the wood is exercised, so that if they do that for a long time, it stops, the instrument becomes unhealthy, it's unbalanced or whatever. So people do affect the instrument, actually, you know, physically the instrument, not just as a, it's not a saying, it's actually true.
Does it drive you crazy to travel with a bass? Would you give it to a bellhop to take up to your hotel room?
Probably not. But it's, you know, I buy seats for it on airplanes, and you go through all those endless, you know, travel procedures, and people saying, no, you can't go on with this cello, even though you have a ticket for it, and, you know, all of these problems. No, it has to be strapped in this way or that way, and but, you know, that's comes with the profession.
When you're on the road, do you try to practice every day? Are there any exercises that you try to do vigilantly during the periods when you're playing?
Well, I think what what you do in practice is to fill in the gaps. I mean, if you're thinking, let's say, during a performance of maybe 20 levels of keeping track of, you know, engaging the musicians that you're playing with, engaging the audience, engaging your own concentration, thinking about all kinds of things, there's always something that goes wrong. Sometimes it's, you may have practiced something very well, but then you start rushing. So go back to the practice room, you work with the metronome, you decide, okay, or, you know, intonation goes after a while. You've worked on something for, and you think you're in great shape, but then if you don't watch it for a while, things start slipping. So you're always trying to plug in the weaknesses, and that's what I work for. And usually that's, I don't work regularly in the sense that, well, I've been playing so much that in a sense I do work regularly, but I'm always working for a goal, a purpose. You know, something is not right. I'm out of shape. The, you know, octaves aren't in tune. I'm actually trying, I'm more or less faking for about 2 minutes because I don't quite understand what's in the music. So I'm just playing the notes. Let's stop that and figure out what is actually happening.
Are you glad to be at an age or arriving at an age where people won't always mention your age before they mention your name because it's such a feat that you're so young?
Yeah, it's a welcome relief. I don't know whether I've gotten to that age yet, but I do feel I'm at another stage in life where you've been around, you're questioning things, you're thinking, you know, what is it that you want to do for the rest of your life? And you know, maybe in a pretty early age to think about things like that, but I think parenthood brings that on. I think just observing what's going on, you know, makes you think about things. And so maybe, you know, whether people think I'm young or not, I'm thinking differently, you know.
Yo-Yo Ma, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
That was cellist Yo-Yo Ma, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineers for this edition were Ron Carson and Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.